Hey everyone, welcome back to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. My guest today is Shane Parrish. Shane is prolific. He's a fantastic investor. He's the founder behind a blog, Farnham Street, that gets millions of visitors every single month. He's also a connoisseur of mental models and frameworks that you can use to live a better life. He's cataloged them in his brand new book, Clear Thinking, which distills the best mental models, the best frameworks for making decisions that impact your life positively. I have been reading Farnham Street since I was in college. I was a valet. I told him this before the interview. I was a valet in school, sitting there on Saturday mornings, waiting for the cars to come in, reading the Farnham Street blog. And so it's pretty surreal that a decade later, I get to interview him on my podcast and learn even more from someone who has impacted my thinking deeply. If you aren't subscribed to his podcast, his newsletter, check out his blog, I encourage you to do so. But before you do that, check out this interview with Shane Parrish. So Shane, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, man. I'm excited to be talking with you.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So I saw that the new book was coming out and I was like, oh, amazing opportunity to potentially get a little bit of Shane's time, get to steal a little bit more of his wisdom than I already have from reading your blog. And in the build up to this conversation, I didn't realize, despite having read you for a long time, that you actually operate multiple businesses. I kind of knew that there was like an investment firm and then the whole kind of Farnham Street blog media. But could you just kind of help me and the audience get an itinerary of the businesses that you operate and how they kind of fit together in the little empire you're building?
Yeah. So right now I've started 4 different businesses that are all operating and successful, sort of by my standards anyway. And so I started Farnham Street Media as the first business and then started Latticework Publishing as the second business. And Latticework basically self-publishes the great mental models. And we go back and we publish books that are out of print that we think should still exist in the world. So it's sort of not the ideal business from an online point of view, but it's a labor of love, right? We recently just published Men in Rubber, which is this book from 1926 that we scanned, we edited, we made it better, we polished it up, made it really nice, and made it accessible to everybody again. And that book is one of the books that I give away most to people. It's by Harvey S. Firestone about the Firestone Tire Company. And it's really about business. And keep in mind, if anybody goes out there and buys it, it was written in 1926. We did not change the language. There's stuff in there we don't agree with. But the idea was just to put that stuff back out in the world. And at one point, I think I owned 10% of the copies in the world. Like I was always buying this book and giving it away to people. And I was tired of paying like $200 to $600 a copy when I'm giving this away to friends. So I was like, oh my God, if anything else, like I'll save money just by us having this. And then I started funneling sort of the cash flow from Farnham Street into an investment company. So I used to co-run an investment firm back in the early 2000s or late 2010-ish. And we wound it down. And part of the reason we wound it down was I didn't like being a steward of other people's capital. I didn't like people being able to be like, hey, you didn't make an investment this year. And I just wanted to invest other people's money like it was my money. And so I decided that I would take the cash flows from Farnham Street and I would do just that. And one of the advantages to having such an online presence as we have with millions of website visitors, over 600,000 people on email, a huge podcast following, is that I get deal flow. And one of the hardest things to get in sort of the private space or family office space is deal flow. And so deals just started coming in. I was like, oh, I never even thought of this. I didn't set out to create this. But what an advantage that Farnham Street gives me in terms of I can now sift through this stuff. And I don't do a lot of VC investing. For anybody out there listening, I'm more into the profitable business space. I like profits. I believe businesses need to operate profitably. I'm not interested in future projections or hockey sticks or anything like that. I occasionally do VC stuff, mostly with friends or something that I feel like should exist in the world. But my bread and butter is just sort of like boring, profitable businesses. And then I started a real estate company through all the proceeds from all of this stuff. And I was like, I really want to get into sort of multifamily residential And I want to invest in generational type assets where there's a couple unique characteristics about a lot of the multifamily deals we do, because we're partnering with people on large multifamily projects. We're not partnering on a 12 unit. We're partnering on like 700 units. And the thing is, you can write the check, but you can never really get out. And so those are the deals where I really like, right? Where you can enter it, you get a long-term relationship with people you trust and love and you want to work with, and you're aligned on values and you're aligned on vision, but you can never really get out. And I think we can write that check in 6 hours. And so I think that there's a unique advantage to the way that we operate, but it's just me operating that. And it's just my money. So if I lose money, it's all on me. My kids will come back to regret my decisions, but yeah.
But I imagine if you lay enough of a foundation there, perhaps you could get over leveraged or be really unwise or perhaps unclear in your thinking. But if you're taking things with the right measured approach, real estate is one of those things that it certainly has some spectacular flameouts, but also has some of the longest standing kind of business fortunes in place.
I'm a firm believer that your position determines your options. And so I never want to be in a position where the circumstances are thinking for me and I can't actually think. It doesn't matter how well I think if I'm forced into something by a bad position. And if you look at, you sort of look back through history and you study the greats like Rockefeller and Carnegie and even Buffett, one of the things that you realize is that they're never caught out of position. They're always in a position to take advantage of circumstances. And that's sort of how I've modeled this whole portfolio in terms of what how I think about leverage, how I think about debt, how I think about loan to value in the real estate sort of investments that we're doing. And so everything operates with incredibly low leverage and a lot of buffer room for when things go wrong or new businesses come in. I mean, we want to start acquiring whole businesses now and going out there and sort of buying 60 to 70% of existing businesses where we can partner with the operator who wants to cash out, or maybe they just want to clean up the cap table. And that's the type of stuff we want to do. And we want to write those checks. So we have to have a big buffer. We have to have cash on the balance sheet. And we never want to be, I think in Buffett's words, dependent on the kindness of strangers.
You cite Buffett a lot, and for folks that don't know, Farnham Street is literally the location of Munger and Buffett's business address for Berkshire Hathaway, and was kind of the origin point, I believe, of all this and kind of charting a completely different career arc. So can you take us back just a little bit to the origins of that blog and how writing blog posts, reflecting on the best ideas that other people have figured out, has translated into such a comprehensive business empire?
So give me a second. I'll give you a bit of the long version. We have to go way back though. So August 2001, I start working for a three-letter intelligence agency. 2 weeks later, September 11th hits. Everybody in that building is thrust into roles and positions that they're not really ready for, but you have to do it. You don't really have a choice. You don't get to opt out. You don't get to go home and get prepared. You just sort of like dive in and do the best you can. And I worked with world-class people at this. And I got to a point where I was starting to make decisions that impacted my team, my organization, my country, other countries, troops in the theater. And I was thinking about, how do I make decisions? How do I learn how to make decisions? Nobody's ever taught me how to make decisions. And there's no class in university called Decision Making 101. And I took computer science, so I'm used to like ones and zeros. I'm not used to this world of people and biology and all of this stuff that factors into these decisions. I'm used to fairly objective, not subjective things. And so I set out to learn about decision making. I started following people around work. I started reading online. I started taking courses online. I went back. I did my MBA. And eventually I sort of concluded that decision making in the real world is really messy. But there's some people who are consistently better at making decisions than other people. That doesn't mean they're perfect, but they're consistently better. And what is it that I can learn from those people about better decisions, better outcomes? And that's where I started this online journal, which at the time was 68131-1440@topblogger.com, which if I remember correctly, was the zip code for Berkshire Hathaway / the unit number for Berkshire Hathaway. Now, don't go to that website now. I don't own it. Some guys picked it up because I talk about it sometimes. But that was just meant for me. This was like an online journal where I'm reflecting on the material that I'm consuming. So I'm reading Warren Buffett's annual letters. I'm reading all of Charlie Munger's speeches. I'm reading Daniel Kahneman. And I'm trying to sort of like meld these things together, and I'm connecting them. And I'm doing it in a way that's online and open. I thought the URL was long and cumbersome, so nobody would ever find the website. And keep in mind, I still worked for the intelligence agency. So at this point in time, I wasn't allowed to have an online profile. I wasn't allowed to have a Facebook page, Twitter, anything. So everything is completely anonymous. And it was just sort of like my record of learning and how I feel. I call it the learning loop. We have an experience. We reflect on that experience. The reflection creates a compression or abstraction. And from that, we go to action. So if you imagine a clock at 12, you have an experience. At 3, you have a reflection. At 6, you have a compression or abstraction. And at 9, you have an action. And this just continuously goes around. Most people think that we learn from experience, now directly or indirectly. But you can have an experience reading a book, having a conversation. Those are different types of experience. Reading is a very good experience, depending on the sources of information that you're consuming. High quality sources lead to high quality reflections, which lead to high quality compressions, which lead to high quality actions. And so I was consuming a lot of high quality, high density, high fidelity information. And I wanted to reflect on it because I need to chew it and digest it and make it my own. And that was how Farnham Street started, which was this online process and still is to this day. It's basically a personal blog. It just happens to be one of the most popular in the world about what I'm learning, what I'm thinking, what I'm digesting. And it's a work in progress. It's always sort of getting better. I'm iterating old articles sometimes, but everything that we talk about is timeless. So it exists for a long period of time. It doesn't really expire. I'm not interested in sort of like this technique or tactic to get more Twitter followers tomorrow, because that just doesn't really interest me. What interests me is, what are the big ideas that I can learn from history and from other people that I can use in my life to better my position so that I can live a more meaningful life?
And you're talking about using a website as like a personal journal. Reminds me a lot of Barry Ritholtz's story of how he basically started his blog to just summarize everything that was going on in the financial crisis, like almost to himself.
Yeah.
And it was a practice that he had used as a trader. And then just by the nature of someone being reflective and detailed and consistent, a lot of value was created for the readers who happened across that asset. And it feels candidly so foreign to the present. And writers like David Perrell have called it like the never ending now. But people in my generation and younger, I see as like hyper conscious of all the implications of putting something out into the world and almost like hyper fixating on the positioning before actually even just like translating the intention into action. So like for almost like the younger generation, I guess it could be anyone, but I see it more in the younger generation. Like, what perspective or advice would you give to the folks that are almost like hyper over self-aware about the positioning and those actions that they would take?
Well, I think a lack of patience changes the outcome. That's one of the sort of compressions that I've come up with. If you set out to create something for other people, you're just going to end up like a whore to what's popular. And if you do that, you're never going to create anything that's really meaningful for you. And you're always going to be at the whims of the crowd. The other mistake that I see is people just trying to monetize way too quickly before they provide value. It's like, sign up for my Substack and pay 10 bucks a month for my newsletter, but I haven't really done anything. I haven't done anything in life. I might have some really good thoughts, but you got to give that stuff away. You got to build an audience. You got to build a following, and you got to get people on your side and people who want to contribute to you and people who want to support what you're doing. And I think that that's our approach. I put out a lot of value for people over a lot of years. And then we slowly sort of like said, okay, well, I got a payroll to make, right? We got a team of people here. We got to start paying people. And I want to do all these other projects. And we have a membership, and that membership supports all of these little pet project ideas that I have that don't really make money, I don't think, but give back to the world in all these meaningful ways. There's two examples of that really come to mind. One is the Great Mental Models book. We spent 6 years writing 4 books on the Great Mental Models, which is sort of like all the big ideas that you would learn in university in each 101 class that you can apply to life. One of my goals in life, my personal goals, is equal opportunity I don't believe in equal outcomes. I do believe in equal opportunity. But to get equal opportunity, we got to get information to people who don't attend university. YouTube's one way to get that. That's fine. But I want to make that information easily accessible to everybody else. You didn't go to physics class. Well, we can teach you the big ideas of physics and how they apply to life. You're not going to get all the mathematical formulas because you're not going to use that in daily life unless you're a physicist. But we can teach you about frame of reference and how that changes how you look at a decision. We can teach you about all these different ideas that you can use. And that project, it's like 5-6 years. It's a lot of years, a lot of labor, a lot of people involved in that project. We're never going to make money on that project, but that wasn't the goal of that project. The goal was to make the world a better place, to give back to the world. The next project that we just started, which is called FS Nourish, which is about how do we bring high quality food to people in an easily accessible way? And I don't mean delivering food. I mean, like, can we provide recipes for parents, busy professionals, people who are working that are really healthy and kid tested, parent approved, delicious for everybody involved, and really health conscious. So we hired a 3-time award-winning chef who now works for us full-time. We're developing our own recipes, we're testing them, and we're going to put this out in the world. And then the second part of this vision that I have is that I want to help underprivileged kids and families. It comes back to positioning, which I'll tie this to in a second. But a lot of kids don't know what healthy food is and what's not healthy food because they're not growing up in an environment where that's explained to them. And that's not their fault, but we can change that and we can help them learn how to prepare food. So the idea is we're going to get like 40 chefs from around the city. We'll test this out in our city and maybe we can do it in other cities too. We'll get 40 chefs and the chefs will come in once a week or for 1 week. So we'll have 40 different weeks, 40 different chefs. They'll prepare these meals with the kids. The kids will take the meal kits home. So they'll do all the prep on site and they'll learn about healthy food and they'll learn real life cooking skills at the same time. And then they'll go home with this meal kit. So they'll be bringing high quality food home. And to make it so it doesn't feel like a charity or a handout or anything that requires donations, the idea is the kids will pick one recipe from each chef, create a cookbook every year, which they can sell online or door to door. So it becomes self-funding. So it's not like a charity case. It's like, no, we're earning this and we're learning at the same time. And what does that do? I mean, we think about sort of like hospitals and hospital beds. Here's a great example of positioning. We think about, oh, how do we increase the number of hospital beds? And it's like, well, that's one way to look at the problem. But another way to look at the problem is, how do we decrease the time that people stay once they're in a hospital? And if they're healthier at the point of getting sick, we're all going to get sick at some point in time. But if you're healthier at that point, we know that on average, you're going to be in the hospital less time than if you're not healthy. So can we start changing how healthy people are on the back end, getting rid of seed oils? This is so controversial. We're just doing our approach, right? Like no seed oils. We're trying to reduce gluten content. We're definitely reducing sugar. And we're creating these recipes and we test them on my kids. And my kids are like the hardest critics of all of this stuff. We tested, to put things in context, my kids hated overnight oats every time I made them. They're super healthy, convenient breakfast for parents, especially on school days. So we tested 17 different versions of overnight oats on my kids. And then we found one they love that is incredibly healthy. So I want to share that with everybody else. Like, I feel like that is, man, parents will love this because you can do that on Sunday and you can get a Monday, Wednesday, Friday out of like 10 minutes of prep on a Sunday and it's healthy for your kids. It's easy to clean up. It's easy to grab. Mornings are the toughest time for parents because the kids get up, they got to go to school, you got to go to work. You're already thinking about all this stuff you have to do. The last thing most parents are thinking about is healthy breakfast. How do we know that? Well, they send their kids loaded with sugar to school, and that creates a bad outcome in school because the kids are hyper and their insulin response is sort of acting up, and it puts teachers in a worse position. So I'm just trying to tackle this problem in a very different way than what we've gone about doing. Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer.
Well, no, I love it. I'm super aligned with that because also think a lot about healthy eating for me, my wife, my two kids. And there's two things that strike me in that answer. Number one is that once you have the means, you have more leverage to go make impact, right? Like to hire that chef to do this testing, to kind of put all these resources together takes the cash flow from the earlier businesses that you invested in, the membership, these other pieces that you've already set up in order to go kind of make that bigger bet into the future. But even preceding that, and that's where I'd like to go with this next question, is the ability to both wait long enough to monetize, but to then monetize confidently. So in preparation for this, I was listening to some past interviews that you've done, and you dropped this little anecdote about as a kid being able to have one glass of milk a day because of the budgetary constraints of your family. And then after graduation, you go into an intelligence agency, a smart dude without question, but by no means a salesman, a business person, a capitalist trained in those conventional means. So can you take us through the kind of initial lessons that you had to learn in order to be able to eventually get to the point where you could make these bigger structures bets, that early monetization, both timing it right, doing it correctly, actually pushing your chips in when the time was appropriate?
I think I did everything wrong. I can tell you all the ways I messed up, like everybody else, right? Especially at the start, I was super hesitant to sort of ask for money. And I would test this with like, hey, let's do this live event and I'll charge like $5 for it. And I thought like asking people for $5 was this crazy sort of thing. And somebody pulled me aside after the first sort of webinar I did, and this was like 2016, 2017, and said, dude, you just gave us like $1,000 of value. You literally changed how I organize my workflow. That's incredibly valuable. You're really underselling yourself. So the next time I did it, of course, I like raised my price, went to 20, and I get the same guy reach out and he's like, you're not listening to me. And then he sort of like revealed a little bit more about himself, and he runs this like $100 million plus business. And he's like, you're missing the boat here. And so I stopped and I sort of thought about it, and I thought differently about content, right? So what do I want to do with content? And I need to monetize because I want to make a living in it. It was never about investing or doing all this other stuff. I mean, at the very start, I quit my job. I got divorced. I quit my job. I started Farnham Street and I cashed in my pension. So I went all in on me. I had no backup plan. There was nothing sort of in the background that was going to support me. So there was a forcing function to monetize, which is like, I need to feed the kids. And how do I monetize? And I like every project to sort of be self-sustainable, but it doesn't have to be self-sustainable at the start. So the podcast, we didn't advertise for years on the podcast. And that's just because I want to prove the concept before I go and ask other people for money with what we're doing. Same as the membership. We didn't do the membership for a long time. And then I was like, okay, we can add value in these ways. And that's a good trade-off for people. And I think they'll support us. And more importantly, I think people want to support us. And I think that that was the means of doing that. And then we use that money to invest back in our ecosystem by hiring better editors, by hiring a staff of people so I'm not making as many mistakes and we can do more things. And then we give all of that back to people. So we're sort of like Amex, right? Like how Amex bribes you with rewards. We do the same thing. So for all the membership money, we basically like plow that back into these pet projects. Members don't get to decide what those pet projects are, but we give all of the information from the pet project sort of back to members. And so it's this win-win and it creates this ecosystem. But then we sort of like, well, what if we do a course, right, on decision-making? What if I take everything I've learned in the past 15 years on what are the specific strategies and behaviors that you can use to make better decisions? And we package it up to people. And then we created the world's number one, I think, online decision-making course called Decision by Design. That is very prescriptive. It's unlike anything I normally do, because normally I'm not theoretical, but I'm like, here's some information, but you have to take this information, digest it, and make it your own. And that's how it's going to be useful. But we decided to take a different approach. And I was like, I'm just going to tell people what to do. I'm going to tell them the exact things that I've seen work over and over again with other people. And that proved to be incredibly successful. Beyond sort of the wildest dreams, we've had people from Amazon and Microsoft and Walmart, and we've had people, even people from government, which is surprising, but we've had all these different industries come through it, and they all say the same thing. This is the most practical, valuable course that I've done in my professional career. And that's really good feedback. And then you have to think, how do I monetize that? What's it worth? If I can improve somebody's decision-making 1%, and they're, let's say they're in their 30s. Well, what is that worth? That's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, we don't charge hundreds of thousands of dollars, but not only is it worth that to the company that they work for, it's worth that to them. So that helped me sort of think about this in a better way, which is like, well, no, I want to charge sort of fair value for that. And then the other mistake that I made at the start was like, I wanted the most number of people to sign up. I got some sort of ego involved in like 5,000 people signed up for my webinar. But now I don't think in terms of those numbers. It's not like I want 5,000 people. I want the people who want to be there. And price often acts as a filter for people who want to play the game. It acts as a filter for people who are involved, dedicated, and want to be there. They want to learn. They want to get something out of it. And so we noticed that as we increased price, support costs went down. We noticed as we increased price, a lot of the questions that we get changed to being better, more thoughtful questions. Because if you're paying more money, you're going to take it seriously. And I do the same thing with talking. I only do, I don't know, 6 to 10 speeches a year. We use price as a filter. And I've found every single time that I've lowered my price point for speeches, it's always way more work than when I'm like, no, here's the baseline. This is what I charge. If you want to do it, great. If not, don't. It doesn't matter to me. And those people are the easiest people to work with because they're not just trying to fill a spot. They want you. And that's what I want. I want people who are like, I want you to teach me how to do decisions. I want to talk to you. I'm buying your course. I'm buying access to you. And how can I make that happen? And how can I make them better? And so I've made all of these pricing mistakes. I still hesitate, even to this day. I really want to take everything that we do and make it free eventually. So on a long enough timeline, I want to take all of this information and make it free and easily accessible. So a lot of the content of Decision by Design is coming out in Clear Thinking, the book that comes out October 3rd. Not all of it, but a decent chunk of it. And part of that is like, I want to give value back to people, not only the people that have supported me, but I want to make the world a better place. And if we can make people think clearer, we can make people decide better, we can put people in better positions, and I think we can really just change the world.
Shane, you did such a beautiful job of tying it all together, because that's where I was leading into basically, was the fact that you can work in this arena, study this, compound, compress all this information. And then we're lucky enough to get access to it distilled in a single book that's on Amazon or whatever now for, what, 20, 30 bucks.
Yeah.
And that is the gift of reading generally. I know we're both mutual fans of David Senra and his ability to say, like, someone lived this amazing life and it was compressed into a single biography. And just what an enormous gift that is. It just got me fired up. I hope that people will go check out the book, Clear Thinking. We're obviously going to link that in the show notes and shout it out at the end as well. But I just want to emphasize that point for the listeners out there.
I appreciate that. And I don't think people realize there's 20 years of sort of what I've amalgamated on thinking from learning from some of the best people in the world, not only indirectly, but directly with a lot of the best people in the world. The conversations I get to have with Cat Cole or Peter Kaufman or Charlie Munger, Daniel Kahneman, the list goes on and on. I want to make that info. It's not fair. I get access to that information and somebody else doesn't. I want to put that out into the world so everybody has access to it, but I want to do it in a different way. Like, we took a very different approach to Clear Thinking, or I took a very different approach to Clear Thinking than sort of anybody else has taken, right? Which, the way that I position the book is, there's three elements to Clear Thinking. And you've probably heard one of these before, but you haven't really heard them all together. The first is, you have to put yourself in the proper position. And the second is, you have to manage your defaults. And the third is, you have to think independently. And those three things work together. And we talked a little bit earlier about positioning. That is so important in so many areas of life. Financially, it's like low debt, saving money. But we can think of it even better, right? Sleep, working out, eating well. I'll give you a great example. One of my sons came home and he barely passed an exam. He got like the lowest grade he's ever got. And he hands it to me, and he's a teenager. And for any of you out there with teenagers, you know the teenage attitude. They come home after school. They got a lot going on in their life, right? He hands this to me. He's like, I did my best, grunts by, and walks away. And I'm like, now is not the moment to tackle this problem. It's the same reason that kids quit sports. Most kids quit sports in the car ride on the way home when the parents are on them. So I'm like, I'm going to let this go. going to get him in a better mood. We're going to talk about it when he's got a clearer head, right? What am I doing? I'm managing his defaults. And then we sit down and we're like, okay, well, talk to me. Well, you said you did your best. I want to understand that. And he's like, well, when I sat down to write the test at 10, I really focused on every question. I did my best on all the questions. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So when he talks about doing his best, which is the way a lot of us talk about doing our best, he meant at the moment of performance. But what he failed to realize is that everything he does leading up to that performance makes that performance easier or harder. So I'm like, well, let's talk about the things in the 3 or 4 days before you did the test that you control 100% within your control that would help you perform on the test. Did you sleep well the night before? No, he did not. He stayed up late. Did you get into a fight with your brother in the morning? Yes, he did. Did you eat a healthy breakfast? No, he skipped breakfast that morning. Did you study in the 2 or 3 days leading up to this? And he knows his proven study method. And he's like, well, I sort of did. Well, okay, well, you didn't do your best because for me, you did your best before the test. So if you come home with the exact same grade, but you did all of that stuff, I'm proud of you, man. That test just kicked your butt. And sometimes that happens in life. You have to put that behind you, move on, move forward, learn from it, all of those things. But that test didn't kick your butt. You kicked your own butt because you put yourself in a bad position to take that test. This is you self-sabotaging and getting in your own way of success. It wasn't that the test was better than you. It's that you didn't do the work required to put yourself in a position to succeed. And if we start thinking about what position we're in, a lot of things really change. You start thinking about your position with your partner or your spouse. Think about all these little petty little fights or passive aggressive comments that turn into arguments somehow. It's like, what position are you in that? Are you investing in your relationship? I can tell you, you're probably not, because if you think there's a little patch of grass between you and your partner or spouse, if that grass is dry, any spark is going to create this big inferno. But if that patch of grass is wet, and it gets wet by investing in your relationship, it gets wet by cuddling and connecting and doing all these little things, it gets wet by weekly date nights. As weird as that sounds, these things work to invest in your partnership with the person you've chosen to spend your life with. And then all those little sparks, what happens when they hit this wet grass? Nothing happens. Your position determines your outcome.
Amen, brother. There's so much more like that in the book. I want to just make sure I hard sell it. That was not enough. You need to go grab the book to really deeply understand these ideas. But one of the last questions I wanted to ask Shane before we kind of aim towards wrapping up here, I want to be respectful of your time, is identifying clear thinking in another. So there's the kind of like tentpole iconic examples, the Buffett and Mungers of the world, who are simultaneously well-written and transparent, but like larger than life figures in some way, shape, or form. And there's zero chance that I'm going to be able to come hire them to work at my company, right? But as I'm trying to surround myself with clear thinkers, I always think of that as kind of a proxy of one good friend, a few good friends with really clear thinking, with a lot of empathy for me. They're going to help me expose my blind spots, my biases that I'm carrying with me inevitably as a human. How can we move forward and identify clear thinkers who, if we're trying to surround ourselves with those type of people, just make that more apparent?
Yeah. So there's two comments. I want to start with blind spots before I go into sort of identifying clear thinkers. The source of all bad decisions is our blind spots. So your perspective is very limited. We learned this in grade 9 physics. You're standing on the train holding a ball. It's going 60 kilometers an hour. How fast is the ball moving? Well, relative to you, the ball's not moving, but relative to somebody watching the train go by, it's moving 60 kilometers an hour. Everything depends on your perspective into the situation. The more perspectives you can have on any given situation, the fewer blind spots you will have. If you have perfect information, you will make perfect decisions. That world doesn't really exist. But the source of all of our decisions, all of our problems with decisions, is that we have a blind spot. How do we identify clear thinking in others? And there's a lot of ways that we talk about in the book, but I want to bring it back to the three things we've already talked about: positioning, manage your defaults, and thinking independently. Who do you know out of your friend group that never seems to like overextend themselves, never seems to borrow money when they don't need to, maybe opportunistically borrows money. The stock market crashes and they borrow money, but doesn't buy the biggest house that they can, doesn't put themselves in a situation where they're going to be dependent on other people, where their loan could be called or they're overly leveraged, doesn't spend, saves their money, right? That's an indication of somebody who's thinking long-term and positioning themselves. And there's all these subtle indications. The other is manage their defaults, right? So the defaults that we talk about in the book are emotion, ego, social, inertia, all of these things. Can they, or do they get angry? Well, somebody who gets angry is going to make really bad decisions. Somebody who's driven by ego is going to make bad decisions. Somebody who just wants to go along with the crowd, they're just going to get the same result that everybody else gets. When you do what everybody else does, you're going to get the same result everybody else gets. The flip side of this is we're all animals. I think we forget this, right? Animals are territorial. They're self-preserving. They're sort of hierarchical. They're ritualistic. We are all of these things. But what separates humans is the ability to insert a little pause and think before we respond. Animals don't think before they respond. We can reason before we respond. So which of your friends seems to have like really good impulse control and is thinking long term? It's not about winning this moment. That's ego, right? Winning the moment is ego, but winning the generation, winning the decade, well, that's thinking long term. Those are the people I want to be around. Who's setting themselves up to win in 10 years versus which of my friends are trying to get rich, trying to win tomorrow? And thinking independently, this is the big one, right? Do they have opinions? They don't force those opinions on you because that's ego, but they can think differently than the crowd and they're confident in their ability to think differently. And I think that those are three indicators. We go through more in the book, but those are three big ones that sort of tie into what we talked about earlier.
Right on. I love that. Win the decade, win the generation is like a very different rallying cry, but definitely the right frame that most of us should be taking. So that's a beautiful note for
like, think about your friends who's trying to win like next year, who's trying to get rich quick, who's trying to take all the shortcuts, who's trying to get the outcome that is possible, but they don't have the patience to get the outcome in the right way. So the strategies that they're employing are mutually exclusive from getting the outcome that they want. Again, it comes back to a lack of patience changes the outcome.
Amen, brother. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your time with us. If folks want to learn more about you, where can they find the book and what other digital coordinates should we point them towards?
Well, you can go to any bookseller, mostly around the world, hopefully by the time this podcast comes out, and Clear Thinking. The book is called Clear Thinking, Turning Ordinary Moments into Extraordinary Outcomes. You can also find it on fs.blog, which is our website, and sign up for our newsletter. We have over 600,000 people reading that every Sunday. It's free. And it's just basically a diary of what I've learned that week and giving you something to think about that's timeless, non-political, none of this stuff that people hate. We're not trying to make you emotional. We're just trying to educate you so you can live a more meaningful life.
It is a auto open. Like there's the email newsletters you subscribe to and it's like, maybe. For me, it's an auto open when I get it every Sunday morning. So I encourage people to diet on some brain food, pick up the book, Clear Thinking. And Shane, before I let you go, I'd like to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge to the audience.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd love to know is if you want to email me directly, I read everything, so I don't respond to everything, but I will read everything. And you read Clear Thinking. I want to know which part of that book changed your life, which part of that book changed your thinking. And the reason I ask this is I've had about 100 people who pre-read the book, some of them for blurbs, but a lot of close friends of mine who've read the book. And the percentage of people who said something changed their life in that book is over 25%. For example, I got a text yesterday from one of my close friends. He's like, hey, the advice on page 113, I started implementing that and literally my life has been different ever since then. And I want to know which page did it for you, which part of that book did it for you, because that'll make me feel really good about putting this out in the world. And I want to know which parts to emphasize, which parts to talk about so I can share that. So if everybody's finding this little esoteric thing really helpful, I want to explode that and share it with everybody else. So you can email me shane@fs.blog. I will read it. I would love to hear from you and thank you.
Amazing. Shane, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I appreciate it.
We just went deep with Shane Parrish. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Thank you so much for listening to the end of my interview with Shane. If you enjoyed it, I'm confident you'd also enjoy the content on my YouTube channel. We have video essays there that help increase your fluency in geopolitics and business. You will think more clearly after consuming some of the video essays on the channel, including our breakdown of why Apple is screwed if China ends up invading Taiwan. I hope that you're able to think more clearly moving forward and continue to listen to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Thank you.